From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for April 28th, 2023. It's the last weekend of the month. The Brewers welcome the California Angels to Milwaukee this weekend. Then they hit the road for games in Denver and San Francisco. And the Milwaukee Bucks playoff run is history. It's already way till next year. And it's National Biological Clock Day. I took the batteries out of my clock years ago. Now I get excited that it's also Blueberry Pie Day.
I thought you still had one that you wound.
I got it before they made batteries. We're going international today. Let's start in Mother Russia. A drunk fell out of a 19th floor window, bounced once, and was basically unharmed. They took him by ambulance to the hospital, and he sang all the way there. See, vodka can't save your life. From British Columbia, Canada, we get this bit of news. A runaway pig named Brenda was aided in her escape when a black bear broke down the fence of her pen. I'm sure the bear was thinking, all right, pork chops on the hoof. And I'm sure Brenda was thinking, not today, Sparky. She was last seen westbound on the Canadian highway. Also from Canada, we hear of a woman that lives in bear country, but isn't all of Canada bear country. She drove her car to the store to restock her food truck, but she left three cases or 72 cans of soda in the car overnight. Try not to get ahead of me here. Well, the black bear broke in and drank 69 cans of soda, mostly Orange Crush, but left behind the diet sodas. And Yogi, who surely has a sweet tooth, wasn't very neat about it either. He dribbled and slobbered all over everything, and he wasn't even housebroken. Needless to say, her car no longer has white interior. And our last sad story is from the foreign land of Texas. Recently, on a farm near Dimmitt, Texas, there was an explosion that killed 18,000 cows. They believe that farm machinery ignited methane gas. If you know anything about farming, you know that with 18,000 cows producing tons of methane gas, the explosion must have been like Hiroshima. On the podcast today, we have Steve Giles, Adam Bailey, Joel Dreesing. And wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max, and what a good week it was, putting a cap on a solid month of April. The NASDAQ finished the week up 1.3%, closing at 12,227. The S&P up 0.9% this week. That's 36 points, closing at 4160. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 0.9% as well, closing at 34,099 after adding 273 points on Friday. For the year, the Dow now up 3.5%, including dividends. The S&P up 9.2%, and the NASDAQ a stellar 17.1%. You know, Adam, as we kind of look at another month in the books this year, 3 of 4 for the year positive, going back really to the kind of first quarter or fourth quarter of last year, 5 out of the last 7, we've been able to string together some pretty positive runs for the market. And yet it seems like despite all of the positive numbers, it doesn't feel as if we've made as much as we have.
Yeah, maybe there's that old adage, the market climbs a wall of worry, and we've had a lot to worry about going into the start of this year, certainly as we started this year with the banking issues, but the market has climbed that. And, you know, to steal a phrase from Art, my colleague Art Rothschild, you know, the texture of the market this week, you know, we traded on just fundamental news, interest rates, earnings. We had a lot of corporate earnings out this week. We had a lot of just core economic activity and data out this week. I know, Joel, you're going to get into that. But the market traded on just the fundamental news, interest rates and earnings. And that's not what we saw last year. Last year, there was a lot of emotional knee-jerk reactions. And it's good to see that, at least in the short term, in the long term, the market can move on just some fundamental news.
Yeah, I think it's always tough to separate kind of that longer-term expectation from some of the near-term noise, and encouraging when we see the market actually doing what we would hope in an environment in which, yeah, the earnings piece hasn't been great, but we also expected it was going to be pretty weak. Steve, the other piece of that, you know, we talk about the importance of balance. A reminder for clients, you know, it wasn't just stocks in April. It hasn't been just stocks really for the better part of the last 6 months. They're getting positive returns across their portfolio.
Yeah, bonds have finally come back to show investors why they are an integral piece of a balanced portfolio. Most everybody's bond funds are up this year, Kyle. I think that it's important to remember that the bond market, like the stock market, is a leading indicator. It's looking out to where it expects things to be. And with the Fed getting very, very close to being done raising rates, I think the bond market is suggesting that perhaps there is a light here at the end of the tunnel.
And, of course, the Fed meets next week. All eyes right now, especially this week, 178 of the S&P 500 companies reporting, more than a third. You know, we're still in the meat of earnings season, and yet with the Fed announcing what we think, at least from market perspective, will be another quarter point rate increase, although you know, I think we're getting to near the end of that based on, you know, what market forecast, market prognostication seems to think. But, you know, I think with the Fed continued in focus, we're discounting, at least for a little while longer, what the earnings picture has looked like, Adam. And fourth quarter, not all that great last year. The first quarter, another earnings decline, maybe even another one in the second quarter this year before we get back to some earnings growth again. You know, how are you justifying for investors right now? You know, yeah, we're seeing these earnings numbers come out and they're not all that great. Better than expected, but the expectations were pretty weak. How do you justify a market up as much as it is in an environment in which it may be a little while before we see that earnings growth again?
I think you got to remember that the market doesn't care so much about what has happened, about what will happen. The market looks forward 6 to 12 months and maybe even a little further and said, okay, well, you know, what's coming down the pike? Because that's really what's important. And you're right, the current environment is that there's not much to write home about when it comes to earnings, certainly not year-over-year earnings. Business is still widely profitable, but they haven't grown their level of earnings from this point last year. But you start looking ahead to the second half of this year, specifically the fourth quarter, there could be some big earnings growth numbers. You know, if that doesn't materialize, that could be an issue for the market. But, I mean, we're talking 8, 9, 10% earnings growth in the fourth quarter of this year. And I like to look out even further than that, maybe for next year and the year following. You know, for what it's worth, the earnings on a single share of the S&P 500, about $220 is what's expected this year. You go to 2024, about $240 expected earnings for next year. The year after next, $275. And these are estimates that are made in today's environment. It's hard to say there's a lot of irrational exuberance. There's a fair amount of pessimism still. Yeah, we're probably going to walk some of those estimates back. But even still, you look ahead to 2025, and if we get anywhere close to $275 on the S&P 500 earnings, that could signal some room to run for the market.
So how much is, excuse me, how much of that is thrown off if, as expected, the Fed doesn't you know, start winding up its interest rate increases? I saw a report from the National Association of Realtors today, and they're expecting later in the year that mortgage rates are going to come down. So that's, you know, making them more optimistic about the housing market. But what if that doesn't happen? What if, I mean, because we don't know for sure what the Fed's going to do.
I think the challenge, of course, is less Fed-specific and more in what economic environment would they need to keep rates high or continue to raise rates. In just about every scenario I can think of, if the Fed thinks they have room to keep rates high for longer or to push rates higher, it's because the economy is strong enough to support it. And so in that environment, yeah, you have some headwind from the Fed then. You have some headwind from interest rates that could keep stock prices in check. But the earnings piece that Adam was talking about, I think, is even more reasonable because you're now doing it in an economic environment in which at least the Fed thinks, hey, we're strong enough to support this.
And keep in mind, too, Joel, that the Fed really can't wait for more complete data to make their decisions. I mean, they're going off of what has happened, and they're trying to look out as much as the market is trying to look out. And I think it's also important to remember that when the market is looking out, they're keeping in mind that all those earnings numbers are being reported year over year. So right now we're comparing earnings numbers relative to where we were 12 months ago. 12 months ago, we were coming off of a pretty nice 2021, and earnings were strong. When we get into the fall, we're going to be comparing earnings in the fall to what were muted earnings numbers in the third and fourth quarters of 2022, which means whatever gets reported is probably going to look much, much better than we are at right now.
And so, you know, kind of put all that together, and then you add in the valuation piece of the conversation with the S&P trading right now at about 18.3, 18.4 times forward earnings. That includes the fact that a couple of those quarters are pretty stagnant or negative growth for earnings. If we roll forward a quarter or two here, and this is something I write about in the newsletter that's going out this afternoon, if we roll forward a quarter or two on the earnings front, if the S&P just trades sideways from here for a couple of quarters, all of a sudden valuations start to look a little closer to average again. And so as we get into, you know, the numbers you're talking about, Adam, for 2024, 2025, I start to get pretty excited about the price of the S&P if we're even close on those numbers. And it's going to matter less whether it comes in the fourth quarter of this year or the first quarter of next year. It matters. We care. But also, if you're a long-term investor, if you've taken care of the short-sightedness of cash needs, of a desire to avoid volatility, the role that cash and safer investments play, you're not concerned whether that rally, the next rally, comes the end of this year, the beginning of next, or even, you know, a year later. You know you're taken care of regardless.
And to the point that the S&P is already up 9.2% this year, Kyle, going sideways will help let earnings catch up with those market prices and avoid a possibility of some kind of crash should the market get too far ahead of itself.
You know, I think the challenge now is that up more than 9% on the S&P, and with the old adage, sell in May and go away, there's this temptation to say, well, this is as good as it's going to get, and so let's just pack it in. We can come back in, you know, in September, October, and figure out what the Santa Claus rally looks like. But for a variety of reasons, and Adam, and I can already see you smirking over there, for a variety of reasons, you know, maybe you don't want to give up on the market at a time in which we've had the kind of rally we've had.
Yeah, you're right. You don't want to give up. It's about time in the market and having patience with stocks and bonds and kind of riding out the ebbs and flows and realizing that there's more good days than bad days, more up days than down days, and so on and so forth. But I was smirking because you use the adage, you know, sell in May and go away. And the first thing I think of is, well, the opposite of that is buy in October and stay. And you know what? That was very true last October. And I know people get a little nervous when October rolls around, but buy in October and stay. I know it doesn't rhyme, but that made a lot of sense this past October.
It did, and maybe we have to figure out a way to fit the rhyming narrative.
Buy in June and feel the swoon.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, plenty of opportunities to figure out how to Dr. Seuss that up a little bit, but I think the reality is that you know, we don't know when the best 5 days of the year are going to hit. They could just as easily come in May, and you miss those best 5 days, you're missing a lot.
Adam, clients ask me all the time if it's a good day to put money to work. Is now a good time to buy? Should we wait for a pullback? And my response is almost always the same. If your time horizon is long enough, you're always going to look smart putting money to work in the market. Mm-hmm. So as long as you have a balanced portfolio and the money that's in stocks is money that you know you're not going to need for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, what do you care if you go through a period of underperformance in the short term, so long as 10 years from now we know that you've made an investment that you'll reap the benefits of after a decade?
Yeah, best time to plant a tree was 10 years ago. The next best time's today, right? So if you're thinking about allowing that money to grow, yeah, as you say, it could look better tomorrow. It could look better 6 months from now. But the only way you get to participate or even have any idea of if this is the best time is if you start putting it to work today. So I agree completely, Steve. You know, Joel, quite a bit of economic data this week. It was a quieter week last week. We've got the Fed in focus next week. And so I think a lot of emphasis put on a couple of the really key data points, things like the gross domestic product report for the first quarter, signs of slowing, but also a lot of nuance there.
Yeah, the GDP report is the biggest report we have of the economy. It looks at the economy's growth overall, and it was a 1.1% annual rate of growth. that we had in the first quarter of 2023. And keep in mind that we have two revisions to that. So that's just sort of a preliminary look. And then as the Bureau of Economic Analysis gets more data, they update that. But one thing that really made that strong was consumer spending. And we know that that's the main thing that drives the economy. But we also had a report today looking at consumer spending for the month of March. And that's showing that consumer spending isn't that strong, that it actually weakened from January to February. And in March, it barely budged. So I'm suspecting that that's something we're going to see in one of the revisions for GDP, and then that's going to bring the GDP down. So that 1.1% increase was the slowest the economy's been since it went backward, you know, the first two quarters of last year.
You know, Joel, I really dug into the GDP numbers as it released this week, and what I found most interesting is how outsized of a role inventories played in this reading. It's hard to understate this one. But inventories, normally when you're rebuilding inventories, it counts towards GDP. When you're spending down inventories, it detracts from GDP. And that's what we had this time around. Had inventories just remained neutral, had we had the same amount of products on the shelves on January 1st as it was on March 31st, GDP would have come in at 3.4%. But here's where I'm going with all of this is that, you know, at some point you sell all the stuff on the shelves and you sell all the stuff in the stock room and you have to restock. And maybe what we're setting up now is a lower than anticipated GDP reading this quarter, but at some point you got to restock the shelves, and that could be a net benefit for economic activity going forward.
Sure, and that's, Adam, that's a good point. And it's also a sign that that manufacturing, that there's not a lot of confidence right now in what's going to happen. So they're not filling the shelves because they figure they're not going to sell their products off of them so soon. And that's what we're seeing in this report. We're seeing that the economy is still relatively strong. It's not going backward yet, but some of the strengths are things like consumer spending. And the weaknesses are things like manufacturing, business investments were slowing, housing. I mean, housing has been negative for the last eight quarters in a row. And those are the areas, especially housing, where the Fed's raising of the interest rates are making a difference.
Well, and that's the point, right? I think it's important to remember how hot the economy was a year, year and a half ago that led to these inflationary pressures. So this slowing of GDP is the direct result and the desired result of the Fed raising rates. The $64,000 question now, Joel, is how much higher do they go without running the risk of pushing us into a full-blown recession?
Right, and remember why they were raising interest rates. That's to slow down the economy so that inflation went down. And the numbers today showed that in March year-to-year, the number that the Fed is supposedly looks at the most for inflation, that number went down to 4.2%. And that's the lowest it's been in almost 2 years.
Yeah, you take a look at just the direction of inflation, and it's clear that we've broken the fever pitch of inflation that was set back last summer. Not entirely well yet, not entirely out of the infirmary, but you take a look at the pace that inflation is declining by, and also the PCE, personal consumption expenditure, which is what the Federal Reserve prefers to look at. You know, we might see an inflation number in the threes, high threes, later on this year, maybe this time next year, something back in that 2% range, which is where their long-term comfort zone is.
And of course, the challenge is sometimes the way the Fed talks about their comfort zone forces their hand on some of this stuff. And so I think as we look at what the Fed's actions are next week, it's as important as the way they talk about those actions. You know, a 2% target makes pretty clear that if they're not at two, they have to do something more. And we've talked at length on this show, you know, internally with clients about the idea of symmetrical inflation targets, that if you run cool for a decade, you can run hot for a little while before you average 2%. And we're there. Certainly the average rate of inflation over extended periods of time is a little closer to two than it has been for a long time. But also know that up until really the last couple of Fed Fed presidents, the 2% number wasn't necessarily what they viewed as kind of the inflation target. It was, all right, what's it going to take for people to stop talking about inflation? That's where we want inflation to be. When they're not talking about it anymore, inflation isn't a problem. And so by putting a hard number on it, you also tie your hands a little bit to how much work you have to do, knowing a couple of things are true. One, by the time you have good data, it's already 3 months overdue. And so you're constantly shooting at a moving target. You've made the bullseye on that target so small that you really got to do more than maybe you otherwise would have. But the point here is inflation can be a vicious cycle. That if you're worried about rising prices, you spend today rather than waiting another 6 months and spending at higher prices. We saw in the personal spending number that the savings rate has gone up again. And so maybe a sign, despite some of the other things we're seeing, that consumers don't feel a need to spend it all today. If anything, they think that maybe they want to shore up their balance sheets a little bit as a way to say, yeah, okay, maybe things might weaken a little further from here. I'd rather wait to see how things shake out and have the cash ready. That's a good sign to me that inflation is on the way down even a little more. Yeah, more work to do, but ultimately, I think a good general thought as far as direction here. As we look at some of the other data, the big one that I always point to is consumer confidence and consumer sentiment numbers. Amazing how the same theme can kind of make its way through all of this. And that is, consumers still concerned about inflation, still weighing on their choices on how to spend, where to spend, when to spend.
Right. Yeah, we had numbers this week from the Conference Board and from the University of Michigan, and both of those show that exact thing, that consumers are still worried about high prices and where those prices are going. The other thing that affects that, though, is how confident they feel in their own personal finances. And with the job market as it is, it's pretty steady. So a lot of people are feeling pretty good. So there's an ambivalence there of people kind of feeling that they can afford to spend, but they're antsy about the inflation rate. So many are postponing things.
I think just more signs that the economy continues to soften, that inflation continues to come down, that, at least for now, the Fed continues to be on the right path in terms of navigating the soft landing or potentially the no landing, the skim of the ground and keeping the economy humming along. And so encouraging signs, plenty to keep an eye on with more earnings next week, with the Fed next week. But overall, I'm pleased with another really strong month in the books.
Thank you for listening to
with
Money
that,
Talk
we
with
enjoy
Bob
doing
Landis.
The program for you. We'll look forward to talking to you
if
again
you
next week.
If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.